by the miracle of recording.
So you get briefs, presumably, from all kinds of different people because you work with all kinds of different businesses. What makes a good creative brief for you?
Well,
have you ever had a good creative brief?
I've had good creative briefs that were then not followed up on. Most of the business that I do right now is with either fairly small clients or music industry clients, and so the briefs tend to be non-existent. The brief tends to be, well, we need something cool for this show, or we need something cool for this record, and it's actually upon me to hammer out a little bit something more definite, because nothing is worse than, oh, we just want you to do your thing. Just do something cool. You know, the sky is the limit is a horrible, horrible brief, because it's debilitating for me, because I have nowhere to start, and it tends to be a lie. So I actually spend probably 25% of any project now talking with the clients and going over, asking them questions and saying, you know, what do you really need this to do? What are you actually hoping to achieve with this?
So if the sky's the limit is a bad place to start,
yeah,
what would be a good place to start?
A good place to start is actually something really, really definitive. Like where you know exactly, okay, we need to talk to these people and we need them to do the following things once they've seen this piece. That's great. And if you can get that in the beginning, and if you can actually get that down fairly precisely, it tends to open up the creative a lot. A bad place is when people say, well, you know, we want it to be blue and we want there to be bubbles in it, because we think that that's probably what people would like to see, and we kind of feel that that's the way to go. If they have a very good understanding of what the problem is, or what the task is that needs to be done, then it becomes really freeing for the creative, and it makes for a really easy presentation of the creative after. Because then you can say, okay, you asked me to do the following things, and this piece needs to move people to come to the show, buy this album, or, you know, buy the following things for the following reasons. And then you can say, well, this is why I've done, you know, because of that, I've done this to the piece. Mm-hmm. And then they usually say, oh, that makes sense. That's great. That works.
So you've worked in agencies. And
yes.
You still work in agencies.
Yes.
Sometimes. And you've worked on your own.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because no one will work with you.
That's true.
And for other reasons. What's the differences?
The difference between working solo and working in an agency? Working
the obvious one.
Well, yeah, I drive a smaller car now. Well, the obvious difference is that I feel much more useful working by myself than I do in an agency, because there's necessarily huge redundancy built into ad agencies, because somebody on any given day needs to bring their A game, and so you have 100 people, so that on any given day one or two people deliver the goods. But that also makes it so that the 98 other people a lot of times go home and feel like, you know, they haven't done anything useful that day. And I have a really hard time dealing with that. And so going solo has been really good for me, only because every day I have to do something useful.
Do you?
Most days, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes it's just a really small thing.
Uh-huh.
But there's usually something that I do every day that helps somebody. And that's pretty good, and that's a pretty good feeling. And when I go into ad agencies now, I come in with that kind of rhythm of wanting to do something and wanting to move things. And I'm always kind of shocked and a little bit dismayed when the infrastructure and the setup is such that I can't do anything. Or I can make some contributions, but it's just more grist for the mill.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
more stuff to get rejected.
More stuff to get rejected. And, you know, more stuff to get approved, but, you know, it's a little bit of a crapshoot. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of factors at work that don't necessarily have to do with the substance of the thing. And, which sounds really bitter. I mean, it's not like everything I do is genius and, mm-hmm. you know, just because it doesn't get approved, you know, means that I'm a misunderstood artist or something like that. But it is, structurally, it's set up that 100 people bring something good to the table and one or two things get picked.
Right.
And,
yeah.
you know, I don't know, my ego is too frail for that. Unless, of course, they pay me incredibly well, in which case I'll be happy to oblige.
Yeah. But you could have done that, couldn't you, probably? You
yeah.
could have settled for incredibly well paid.
And yeah.
happy to oblige, but you've not.
It's come up, and it's actually really hard to explain to your parents why not taking a really sort of ridiculously huge paycheck is a really good move in the long run. And the only reason I have the luxury of rejecting that kind of stuff is because I don't have a family.
Mm-hmm.
I live a really small lifestyle by choice and by design. Which is a greed control thing that I talk about a lot when I talk to other designers or when I talk to students. And that is, if I keep my overhead fairly low, then I can have the luxury of saying no to bad projects. Or to projects that aren't necessarily bad, but that may be a bad fit for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because there have been really great projects that have come my way that were just a bad fit for me. And so this gives me more of an opportunity to edit my work by the jobs that I take on.
Mm-hmm. What made you want to do what you do?
I never had a choice. it was pretty clear from early on. I mean, I've drawn for as far back as I can remember, and I got my first things in the fanzine at 12 years old, and I was just completely, oh, Der Donaldist, a German magazine dedicated to the scientific study of Donald Duck comics, made up of 600 college students and professors, and I was just in there for being able to draw the damn things.
Have you still got a copy?
Oh, many. and I totally took over. I had one drawing in there. I was so hooked on getting my stuff printed. But I totally took over, and I did all the mastheads, and I did all the headers and stuff. And from that, I went into selling ads door to door in Germany, coming here, doing illustration, doing advertising.
I get from what you were saying about the Donald Duck thing and other things. I get the sense that your biggest satisfaction is just seeing the stuff exist.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, creating the objects
uh-huh.
is definitely where I get my kicks. Which is why writing the book was actually a lot harder than making designs, only because it's an enormous amount of work either way.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of a really long night of working, it's much more satisfying to see some new design or some new illustration versus seeing a sheaf of paper,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
with text that you've written.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a real satisfaction in making the objects and seeing them out there.
Do you get exploited because of that feeling? Or exploited might be the wrong word, but...
No, it's not a bad word. I do get exploited because I work harder than maybe is financially prudent on a lot of projects, because I feel really responsible for the object that comes out at the end.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I set myself up to be exploited that way. And I'm happy that somebody cares enough to let me do the stuff to that level. The stuff that's actually most frustrating is where they don't let me be exploited, where they say, well, we've got X amount of money, we've got X amount of time, please stop now.
Right.
We only want something very average. Which I've had. I mean, I did a really big music project where they kept telling me, we needed to look more average. We needed the music. This is a remix CD of stuff that's already available somewhere else. Right now, it looks too original. It needs to look much more generic. And that kind of stuff just kills me.
That must be quite an interesting intellectual.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it's like, what do you, you know, what do you do? I mean, how do I do my job where I obviously wanted to have something really killer because it was a really big name?
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, how do I fulfill their brief, which is, this is a crass commercial, you know, money extraction project.
Mm-hmm.
And we needed to look that way. it's a bit of a line to walk. Well, I just kept throwing stuff at the wall to see what stuck. I did a number of things that I was really happy with that they said, no, it's just too idiosyncratic. It just needs to be more generic. And then ultimately the creative director, it dragged on for about 3 months, and ultimately the creative director from the label called me and said, listen, I'm seeing this guy tomorrow. I'm actually flying out. I'm going to meet with him. Give me something really, really generic so that I have something I can sell. And I did something just incredibly simple and typographic and just kind of went on Swiss modern autopilot. And it looked nice. I mean, and that's what they ended up selling.
Mm-hmm.
And it looked really nice, and afterwards I just went around and I said that I fought tooth and nail to keep it really simple and minimal.
By the miracle of recording.